Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. If I'm estimating correctly, this will be our last episode of this lively diary. We've come a long way with our writer. In our last episode, she seemed to sense that a huge change in her life was coming along with the birth of her baby. In this diary, she wrote of her initial sense of adventure, which resulted in her going to teach English in Puerto Rico. While there, she met her Captain Fred, then married him and sailed with him north and south along coasts of all the Americas, as he took on and discharged his various cargoes. Dorothea has learned that her seagoing life is fairly incomprehensible to those she calls landlubbers, but she wouldn't trade this adventure or her husband, Captain Fred, for anything. Let's learn how this diary ends. December 11, 1912, at home in Herring Gut, known to the better element as Port Clyde. Eva Borden came with us to Maine, and she was such a rock to lean on through all the trials we've had since that entry I made when sailing away from Puerto Rico. There's been so much to write about, but no time to write. Now, as I get well from my long siege, there's finally time, and as Dr. North forbids me any activity, I can find time to read and write by the fireplace, which I love, and over which there is a large and lovely painting of my ship, the Hopkins. Captain J.W. was shot on board his schooner while at Martinique. He died there, and the body was shipped home for burial on the ridge. From what I gather, he and the ship's engineer, one Cook, who Fred said was never any good and who, Fred said, should have been strangled at the time Fred had his hands on Cook's throat, went ashore to deliver some revolvers requested by a local Frenchman from a past trip. The Frenchman refused the guns. Captain Will went back to the ship, but the engineer went to a rum shop. When he returned on board, he was crazed and went aft to where Captain J.W. was sleeping in his hammock, and shot him. Captain Will's last words, heard by the mate and several crew members, were, "Everything goes to Fred. My poor boy is now saddled with not only going out to Martinique at the consul's request for the trial of Cook, but he also has to tend the local Bellano interests, the water company, the tenements, the wood business, and the sale of the Walwyn Knock to the Harrises, who have never paid all the bills regarding the purchase of that lovely place, which should never have been sold. I'd love to live there." I was confined for weeks at Knox Hospital, my baby boy having been the first baby born there. James Wilfred, named for his grandfather who would have loved him, but whom he will never see, is a dear, precious little darling son, born on September 2nd, his father's birthday. He's now just over 3 months and had to be put on a bottle, poor little chap, because his mother didn't take care of herself on her rovings and drink enough milk with the salt mackerel. Was just interrupted by Isaiah Bellano delivering the wood for my winter fireplace fire. He also dumped off a load for the schoolhouse, and the roar woke Wilfred. I told Isaiah about his brother's death and let him read Fred's letter from Martinique. The jurymen of the murder were 12 French-speaking blacks. Fred is going from Martinique down to Barbados, and thence home on the mail steamer to New York. I wrote to find out his arrival date and shall go to New York to meet him, no matter what Dr. North says against my trip. The poor boy needs me now more than ever, and just to think that a year ago we were so happily entering lovely Rio. And I was hurt because Fred was giving me a gangway instead of a baby. Now I have both, however, and can't wait to see Wilfred creeping up the gangway, bound for Rio, all three of us. Friday, December 13th, 1912. I told Dr. North, a wonderful physician, to go back to Bowdoin College and study some psychology, in order to learn that the best cure for a woman is to go and meet her husband. He laughed, and said he guessed Captain Fred could find his way home without my navigation. So I read Daddy Longlegs by the lovely fire, about a girl who wrote letters to a man she didn't know, but later married. Very bright, but quite dangerous for her. A letter from Puerto Rico tells me that my good old friend, Mr. Benedict of Tajillo, has passed away, leaving a pregnant widow who has gone to her brother's in Mississippi. Little Bernard has been shipped off to his sister, Mabel, my old teaching comrade at Utuado, who now lives in Oneonta, New York, and whom I shall visit if I can make the trip to meet Fred at the dock in New York City. But Dr. North says my convalescence still needs inactivity for a month of Sundays. No news from the Hopkins, temporarily commanded by another, or from Fred, or from the Royal Mail about the ship on which Fred is supposed to arrive from Barbados. I'd convalesce faster if Jim Wilson and his rushing horses would get me something in the mail instead of magazines, advertisements, and bills. Why doesn't Fred telegraph me? Why doesn't he take the French steamer from Fort de France? Has he the typically English and American distaste and distrust of French ships? I'd love wine with my meals and a dish of bouillabaisse before my filet mignon and grape suzettes to top it off, with a bit of camembert to boot. It would be a welcome and far cry from Mother B's menu of cold porridge for breakfast, stale ham for lunch, and crackers with milk, sour milk at that, for supper. Her penny-pinching affects my health also, with the lack of heat. Captain J.W. installed a hot-water system for heating, radiators, and a new coal-burning furnace, but she won't use it because the price of coal is greater than the cost of cutting wood from her own woodlots. That would be reasonable, I suppose, if she allowed the cutters to cut more than what is needed for her kitchen stove and a bit for the fireplace, but she doesn't. The radiators must be frozen because there's no heat in the upstairs bedrooms. To keep from freezing, I must nap by the fireplace. Although some days she's not so vexing as usual, I do wait for Fred to straighten her out. Childbirth was not the cure-all for me that she claims it was for her. Why did she have just one child? And I am in pain so often that I can't fight, especially in her own home. To escape for a short while, I attended the sewing circle at the Advent Church, and tonight will go to the annual sale at Mrs. Marshall's Bazaar. Shall have the Tippetts girl in to care for Wilfred. She is so attentive and sweet with him, and would never let him come to any harm. At Mrs. Marshall's I bought little Dutch bonnets made by Lena Harris. They are so fetching and make lovely presents. The center part is blue and pink muslin, with white embroidery and matching colors. I shall send one to Eva Boyden, who is spending the year at Forado, in a splendid position as principal. Awfully glad for the wondrous girl. Must get baby's photos from Rockland. Must get together a group interested in having a village library. There's so much to do that I shouldn't let Mother B bother me. How I do miss Fred, who has been twice as gentle to me since his father died, not nearly so cross. It will be 5 weeks tomorrow that my poor boy has been gone on his fruitless errand. The jury acquitted the murderer, and the consul wrote me privately that he believes it was due to the blacks being so scared of white Frenchmen having guns. They ignored the murder and ganged up against gun-running. I do find some sympathy with them, I must admit, and wasn't it a shame that Captain J.W. should get involved in such foolishness? But, as the consul wrote, every skipper visiting Martinique is requested to bring in guns. The situation, he says, is such that the whites, a tiny minority, feel threatened every hour of the day and night and must protect themselves or flee their island. I got word of Fred's arrival date and telegraphed Cousin Roscoe to meet him. shall try to get shiftless Roy Hupper, he who mismanages the waterworks, to drive me in the machine to Thomaston when Fred's train arrives. December 16th, 1912. Hurrah! Hurrah! Came a telegram this morning from Fred. He arrived in New York and is coming home at once. I am so glad. He'll get the furnace going, and rub my back, and play with his little son. Wilfred laughed so coyly at me when I told him his daddy was coming home. You'd think he almost understood. He is a perfect dear, and more fun than a basket of monkeys. December 17th, 1912. Fred came home on the SS Monhegan today. I had made fudge and stuffed dates for him. I had also decorated our room and embroidered pillows for his homecoming. I should have known better. All the thanks I got was, "Where in hell have you hidden Nellie's pillow?" Also, I purposely gave up an invitation to meet with my library group because Fred was coming home, and damned if he didn't go out and spend the whole evening with nasty Pierce Hupper, his bastard cousin. I do get so everlastingly weary of being the only one to do the square thing, and how my poor back does ache from doing all those things for his arrival. I'd better get him away from his mother soon. Shall we go to tea in the Hopkins or in Father J.W.'s Margaret Thomas? I don't care, just so long as we go. Shall we go to sea in the Hopkins? Sorry. December 22nd, 1912. Uptown to Rockland today after the bad storm yesterday. Had to go on the mail carriage with Jim Wilson's racing horses because the snow was too deep for the Regal to manage. We got stuck three times before we got out of the village. Bought Christmas cards and many goodies at Fuller Cobb's. Tried condensed milk for Wilfred so he can get used to it before going on shipboard. Used some this evening instead of sending young Alton up to Leonard Seavey's for fresh milk. Editor's note, Leonard Seavey lived up Horse Point Road in the house taken over later by N.C. Wyeth, where Andrew Wyeth spent his summers. Back to our text. Have received many packages from friends, but shall not open them until Christmas morning. Sent Sister Nettie a bracelet from Rio, and Sister Myra a check for $25 to help out at the university. Must thank Fred for being able to do so much more than I ever used to be able to do about giving presents. Much of what I wrote about his stinginess in the first part of these diaries should be deleted. He has a native generosity which, sometimes, allows him to overcome his mother's training toward making every penny holler for mercy. December 23rd, 1912. Took Grandma Bellano her Christmas presents, baby's photo, and a white woolen vest. Mailed Cousin Marjorie's and Aunt Mary's presents, also from Rio. Also went into the woods and selected Wilfred's Christmas tree, baked Indian pudding, and trotted down cellar for raspberry sauce to top it with. Did a thousand things to keep busy. Wilfred seems to thrive on condensed milk, and that makes me happy, because he will soon go to sea, where that is all we can supply him with. Now, Mr. Diary, here's a proposition for you, or a riddle to solve. It is about living with Fred's mother. Fred never did stay at home evenings, and never will. He is the prima donna in that low-life Pierce's store, glorying in being admired by the lobstermen, the factory workers, and the coastal sailors. How do I manage to move into the little house across from the chapel right away, so that when we return from our trips at sea, I shall have my own home? Fred merely sleeps at his mother's and can't stand being there during waking hours. Do I tell him that I can't stand it either? He should understand, but will he? I doubt it. But if I were to spend my evenings out, as he does, where would I go? I certainly don't want to listen to the women's gossip every evening, and I don't dare talk to anyone here of anything besides who is sleeping with whom. Shall I just walk out and startle him? Think it over. I'll be waiting. January 2nd, 1913. Son Billy is 4 months old today, and a dear little fellow, too. He has sported short clothes since his daddy got the furnace going, and weighs 15 pounds. His foolish mamma wheeled him all the way over to Watson Bellano's today to see his great-grandmother, and resultamente, his mamma has a furious backache. Letters from Myra and Aunt Sue. Heard today that the SS Savannah was lost on Frying Pan Shoals, and Captain Giles's schooner was lost off Sandy Hook. I became a member of the Eastern Star, although I don't want to be a joiner. The Masonic Order is very strong in St. George, what with so many descendants of Scots and Scots-Irish Protestants. The members see to it that their lodge brothers are selectmen and tax assessors and sheriffs. Woe betide a Catholic who enters here, although he'd never know what he was up against until it hit him. Huey Dunn, he of legend, was a Catholic. 'Tis said of him that he jumped overboard in Halifax Harbor, escaping with a fellow Irishman from a British frigate back in the 70s. In the icy waters, Huey said he was cold, and his mate told him to turn up his coat collar. He wore it ever afterwards turned up, but he changed his religion soon after finding out that he couldn't get a job in any of the local factories. After that, he prospered. After Fred's bout with Mother B about the price of coal, he now talks of building a coal shed on the shore and dealing in coal. However, it seems as if that dream is on the level with buying a farm out west, because when a report came today that the Hopkins had been reported off Montauk, Fred told me to get ready to leave with him to join her. I'm worried about Billy getting along on condensed milk, but I must go and take him with me. The lamp has gone out here in this gloomy, gloomy house, and I want no more of this sadness. As Dawsey would say, I done got to miseries. And Fred just won't stay at home. Once away at sea, I shall recover quickly, I know, and Billy will be all right. I shall consult every doctor at Harvard about getting the right formula for his health. Then, when we return to Herring Gut, I shall have my own place, and as Fred said en route to Rio, it will have a fireplace, a good bath, a furnace, and something he didn't add, a full library. January 6, 1913. At sea! Glory be! And it's Three Kings Day, too. What a wonderful present from the Three Kings, Los Tres Reyes Magicos. We are loaded to the gunwales with a full cargo for enchanting England. I wonder, did Mr. and Mrs. Likes have anything to do with this? Maybe, because we have scores of long masts on deck as load. On deck last night my diamonds sparkled in the starlight, and so did I, Fred said. Our baby turned in his little hammock and sighed. The nanny goat, recommended by the Harvard professors, blatted a protest about being milked by the old steward for Billy's midnight milk, and the little kitten Fred got for Billy came purring at my feet for protection against the cold, which I don't feel because I am all warm inside. I am speaking Spanish as well as English to our son, and, for myself, learning French. We shall do England before crossing over to Bordeaux to load wine for Boston. Selah. Thus we conclude the log of the skipper's wife. Personally, I'm very grateful to Dorothea Moulton Bellano for writing it, and for her son, who changed his name, apparently from Wilfred, his middle name, to James Bellano, for seeing it through publication by Down East Books. We've a little time left in this episode. I'll read briefly about the life of another seafarer, Captain Charles C. Duncan, who lived from 1821 to 1898. He is responsible for creating the luxury cruise at sea, an experience quite different from the one we've just finished reading. This selection comes from The Maine Reader, edited by Charles and Samuela Shane, and published by Nonpareil Books in 1991. Captain Charles C. Duncan of Bath was a Maine worthy whose 77 years spanned the great decades of Maine shipbuilding and transatlantic shipping, and who deserves to be better remembered than he is. In those days, if you were born and raised in Bath and were ambitious, your future was almost sure to be in ships and shipping. Duncan was a ship's master at 23, and in 1853, after 58 transatlantic crossings, he went ashore in Brooklyn and opened an office on Wall Street as a ship broker. He fathered 16 children. During the Civil War, he was in England, trying to run a branch of his firm in Liverpool at a time when trade between Europe and America had come almost to a standstill. In 1864, one of his ships, the Emma Jane, named for his first daughter, was captured and burned off India's Malabar coast by the famous Confederate raider, the Alabama. When the war ended, Duncan returned to Brooklyn to take on, among his other family and shipping activities, his role as the superintendent of the Sunday School of the Plymouth Congregational Church, which was led by the most famous preacher of the age, Henry Ward Beecher. On Sundays, 2,500 people came to hear Beecher preach. Beecher let it be known that he was planning to write A New Life of Christ and was considering an absence from his pulpit to visit the Holy Land. Duncan had a better idea. Charter a ship, invite others, especially members of the congregation, to join the voyage, and make leisurely stops at other ports of call along the way. This idea led to two significant cultural debuts of the mid-19th century. One was marine history's first luxury cruise. In 1867, Duncan's charter, the 1,900-ton sidewheeler Quaker City, carried 70 wealthy Americans on a 5-month tour of the Mediterranean. Beecher didn't go. He decided to write a novel instead. The conception of the excursion, as it was called, was so new to the ports they entered that in Algiers, Captain Duncan was asked by the harbor master whether his ship was a merchant vessel or a man of war. The answer, a yacht. Later, in Yalta, where the Americans were received by the Tsar, a Russian woman asked if the travelers were all related. The other debut that will be forever associated with the Grand Holy Land pleasure excursion was that of the journalist and humorous lecturer from California who called himself Mark Twain. His San Francisco newspaper paid his fare of $1,250, the investment to be repaid by 50 letters written along the way. These letters became Samuel Clemens's first book, The Innocents Abroad. It was a smashing success. In writing it, he found his public, the prosperous post-war American middle class, and his literary mission to mock their not-so-innocent lives. Ironically, Duncan suffered painfully for his brilliant invention of the luxury cruise. He too had gained prominence from the trip, and in one of his public lectures he unwisely reported that when Mark Twain had come to sign on for the cruise, he was drunk. Clemens took this comment as a challenge and began one of his bitter public quarrels, conducted in letters and interviews in the New York Times. Duncan had become, in 1872, the first shipping commissioner of the Port of New York, a federal office created by Congress to protect the rights of sailors. He held the post for 12 years, but was at last dismissed by a federal judge amid charges of malfeasance in office. Mark Twain's public vendetta against him helped, it appears, to set a hostile tone in the federal courtroom. Near the end of his life, Duncan began a personal memoir, from which excerpts are taken. These excerpts follow in the main reader. We don't have time to read them, but there's an autobiography of Captain Charles C. Duncan, and another story of life at sea follows. Perhaps some other time we'll read that. We know it's coming. Interestingly, Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose husband was the preacher who actually provided the impetus for that luxury cruise, the first in marine history, has a little bit of excerpts and a bio of her, too. There's so much wonderful history in Maine, and I hope that we get to share some of it together another time. That's all we have time for in this edition of the Maine Reader. We've finished reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, The Diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son James W. Wilfred Bellano. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.